This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In July of 1961, social psychologist Stanley Milgram conducted the first in a series of experiments that would become infamous. Here he is talking about why he wanted to test obedience to authority.
When I learn of incidents such as the massacre of millions of men, women, and children perpetrated by the Nazis in World War II, how is it possible, I ask myself, that ordinary people who are courteous and decent in everyday life can act callously, inhumanely, without any limitations of conscience?
What became known as the Milgram experiment involved a knowing volunteer playing the learner role and a subject in the teacher role who was instructed to administer increasingly strong electric shocks to the learner for getting questions wrong on a test. As you'll hear, an authority figure prodded the subjects to continue inflicting pain no matter what.
You're going to get a shock, 180 volts.
I'm not going to kill that man, eh? I mean, who's going to take the responsibility if anything happens to that gentleman?
I'm responsible for anything that happens here. Continue, please.
The test has been replicated since in several countries and yielded consistent results. Between 61 to 66% of subjects were prepared to administer potentially fatal voltages to the learners. People were horrified by the experiment, and Milgram was censured professionally and personally. Writer and editor Malcolm Harris looked into why an experiment so criticized is known to so many and replicated still. Malcolm Harris is editor with The New Inquiry. He's also a writer based in Brooklyn. His article, The Psychology of Torture, appears at eon.com. And Malcolm, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I gave a brief sketch of the experiment there. Anything else you'd like to tell us about how it was conducted or the results?
Well, I think one of the most interesting things about it is the way he got started, which was studying conformity, group conformity. So he originally wanted to find out how a group could persuade an individual to shock someone. But while he was developing that, the control he had to establish was how they would respond to an individual telling them to shock somebody. This is when he discovered what he found to be much more compelling, which was individual obedience, the obedience to an authority.
There were charges of cruelty. Milgram was kicked off the tenure track at Yale. How about today? What do research psychologists think of this test today?
There are two things. On one level, people know that it wouldn't pass the review boards in the same way that it was at the time. It's sort of a cautionary tale for what can happen to you in your career if you don't adhere by proper protocols. On the other hand, it's still one of the most revered experiments of all time.
So give us some context here, Malcolm. What else was going on at the time of the trial that might influence how the results were seen?
Well, a lot of commentators bring up the trials at Nuremberg were going on during the same time as the experiment. And these trials of Nazi war criminals heavily influenced Milgram's thinking at the time, as well as the public's. The idea of how individuals could be responsible for these sort of mass atrocities, yet not hold themselves responsible, be able to face people and explain what they've done with a straight face.
Mm. Now, Milgram paid a pretty heavy cost as a young age. What do we know about him as a person, and what was driving him to these experiments?
Well, it's speculation on my part, and I do a little bit of that in the piece itself, but he's quite frank about how the Holocaust impacted his psychology as a researcher. As a child, his family took in a relative who had been displaced, and this had a profound effect on the adolescent Milgram that stayed with him throughout his professional career. The Holocaust pursued him, I think, at every stage of his career.
Hmm. Well, the experiments were conducted before he was even 30. He died quite young, at 51, after several heart attacks.
It's true.
Any evidence that he was haunted by this legacy?
His own testimony and letters to friends and colleagues show the picture of someone who's very prepossessed by these thoughts and horrified, and really had to square what he knew about human performance on these tests with trying to live in the world where he knew people could do these kinds of things.
Well, what do you think he thought would happen in these experiments?
Well, when he set up the experiment in the first place, he was trying to demonstrate that Germans in particular were cruel or subject to malevolent authority. So he's trying to do a cross-cultural comparison to sort of distance maybe himself and the rest of us from the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm. Malcolm, why is this still considered a watershed experiment, if not considered great science?
Well, it opened up huge areas of study. The results changed the views of what human nature was, I think, and set up other researchers to pursue those topics that he, along with others at the same time, were experimenting with. It was also it's hard to underplay how popular it was at the time, and it was a media phenomenon at its own time as well.
And your grandfather, he was a clinical psychologist and a contemporary of Milgram's. Now, what did he have to say about how it was thought of at the time?
Well, not even how it was thought of at the time, but as a clinical psychologist, I think he was more attuned to maybe Milgram as a character in his psychology. And he always shook his head and said, poor Stanley, wish he'd never started the whole thing. Because the symbolism of him dying after his fifth heart attack at such a young age is really striking, given that's what they were pretending to induce in the subjects.
Now, what do you think? Do you agree with your grandfather? Do you think he was hard done by?
Again, it's he was so young when he came upon this idea for an experiment, and it really was a revolutionary idea in a lot of ways. But he faced the consequences of that forever. To live with one idea for the rest of your life is really intense, especially when it's such a dramatic concept.
So could or would it be replicated today?
Oh, yeah, it is in various forms, in various places, with various different controls. Absolutely.
So people are still given that sort of idea of they're shocking somebody, torturing somebody?
Absolutely. They tried with game show hosts. They've tried it with they tried one with not an actual human subject who's pretending to be shocked, but a digital person. The basic formulation still interests people very much.
I'm wondering, given all that we know now about torture used as interrogation tactics, you know, during the so-called war on terror, waterboarding, sleep deprivation, would results be consistent with the original shock experiments? And would they be as surprising as they were to the public in 1961 and since?
Well, I think I don't want to speculate about results, but I think if the Milgram experiments were replicated again today and showed the same results, I don't think people would be surprised. They haven't been, as they've seen it replicated.
Well, Malcolm Harris, a fascinating portrait of a fascinating man. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me, Virginia.
Malcolm Harris is editor at The New Inquiry. He's also a writer based in Brooklyn. And his article, The Psychology of Torture, appears at eon.com. And you can read it for yourself. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, we're going to hear from the psychiatrist who first diagnosed winter blues as seasonal affective disorder. He puts another theory to the test. Is there any truth to the old trope, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger? We'll find out when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger, a variation on a Nietzsche quote adapted by coaches, well-meaning friends, and more recently, pop singer Kelly Clarkson as an anthem for jilted lovers. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Stand a little taller. No one of us escapes life's obstacles, failures, illness, limitations, trauma, or loss. So is there an upside to being pushed to the brink? Dr. Norman Rosenthal has learned a lot about adversity. He grew up in apartheid-era South Africa and survived a brutal stabbing while in med school. He's the first psychiatrist to diagnose winter depression as seasonal affective disorder and to prescribe medication for treating PTSD, despite resistance from many of his peers. After decades of helping people face terrible hardship, he's come up with some tools to rob adversity of its paralyzing power. His most recent book is The Gift of Adversity, which is now out in paperback. And Dr. Rosenthal, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Well, thank you.
So do Nietzsche and the coaches and the pop singers of the world have it right? Does adversity make us stronger?
Yes, Nietzsche really does have it right because it makes us stronger, but only if it doesn't kill us. So I think some adversity is good, but too much adversity is too much. The comedian Russell Brand actually gave me a very funny endorsement when he said that just when he read the book, he wanted to run out into the street and get arrested just for the sheer adversity of it. So
I'm guessing you're not encouraging that.
No, please don't run out into the street, but you know, if you do happen to be in the street and get knocked over, well, then that's something that you have to deal with.
Well, you give us a lot of tools in the book. Storytelling is a big component, and you share many stories of adversity. But it's also one of your recommendations for dealing with adversity, to make a story out of it. Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, our verbal analytic left brain is a very, very powerful tool. And often we're experiencing emotions with other parts of our brain that are not quite as organized and analytic. So to bring these highly emotional experiences under the lens of our powerful verbal and analytical skills can be enormously helpful and cathartic. And there's a lot of data, actually, that suggests that as little as writing down what you've suffered and you feel about it, for as little as 4 episodes, 20 minutes each, can actually have long-term enduring benefits.
Is there a particular story from the book that illustrates to you the power of adversity best?
You know, there are so many stories, but I think perhaps the most, 2 of them really, in terms of my own stories. The one is being stabbed, nearly getting killed, and then coming back from it, so to speak, made me really appreciate the power and value of every day of my life. It infused and informed me with a sense of purpose that has been with me ever since. You know, once you almost lose something, you never really take it for granted anymore.
How long did it take for that to come to you, Dr. Rosenthal? I mean, I do think of things that happened in my life that now feel like lessons. Maybe didn't realize that when it was going on. But is there enough, is there a kind of timeline of being able to look back and see the benefit, or a timeline to feel sorry for yourself and then summon another part of yourself and look at it differently?
You know, I tell you, in that particular case, it came on almost immediately. It almost felt biological. Like men returning from war who want to get married, have a family, leave a mark on the world, realizing that they are just so lucky to be alive. It sort of was almost immediate.
Well, in your case, it shaped where you went afterwards. You did come to the United States, and it's making me think of something. At the end of each of the chapters, there's a little summary of the lesson, and one of them says, learn to accept reality. It will improve your life and can make the difference between life and death. So obviously, you accepted what happened. How can acceptance save a life?
Imagine a woman feels a little lump in her breast during a self-exam, or she's just washing herself, she feels a little lump in her breast, and she says, well, it's probably nothing. I don't have any breast cancer in my family. And, oh my goodness, it's late. I've got to take the kids to wherever. And it just goes out of her mind. And then maybe a week later, she feels it again, but she thinks, it's no bigger than it was last week, and I've got a doctor's appointment in 3 months' time anyway. You know, that's denial, or it can be even a different situation. Take a work situation where you're getting lots of signals that they're not really valuing you, that they're making you redundant. And then all of a sudden, you're called into the office and, sorry, this is going to be your last pay period. Because if you don't really recognize these things early, you lose the opportunity to intervene when it can help you the most.
But is short-term denial or compartmentalization, let's say, you know, putting something on the shelf, is it ever beneficial to dealing with trauma or other obstacles that could paralyze the rest of your life?
Well, I think it can be. Like, you know, it's quite common when you lose a loved one, you know, not want to get rid of his or her clothes from the closet because they remind you of him or her. But then it comes a time when you say, you know, I need to get on with my life. And if I'm opening the closet and every time I look in the closet, I see my deceased spouse's clothes, that's making me sort of prevent me from accepting that the spouse is never going to come back.
Mm-hmm. So you are presenting our response to adversity as a choice. And you even pull from the Shakespeare quote, referring to the sweet uses of adversity. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the tools we can use when we can't find any sweet side to difficulty?
Well, sometimes we need to just sit with the pain. But I think often, you know, difficulty shared is difficulty halved, as the Swedish proverb goes. And if we can have a friend to talk to, or sometimes we need to go and help somebody else who's in a less fortunate position. And it kind of reminds us that there are people who are worse off than we are. And so there are many things one can do. Make oneself useful. I think that often boosts one's self-esteem. But also there's a kind of taking care of oneself. There's going for walks, there's enjoying nature, there's enjoying the things you can enjoy. You might say to yourself, these are the things that I cannot enjoy, but what can I enjoy? I recently saw or read an amazing fact that people who had strokes to the extent that they were unable to communicate except maybe through eye blinks.
Mm-hmm.
Now you'd think that that must be the most horrendous state to be in. But evidence suggests that after a certain amount of time has passed, they can become as happy as average people. They adjust. They make their internal adjustments. And just knowing that it can be done gives you strength all by itself.
Have you found in your practice that there are some people who can take that adversity and turn it into something and be fulfilled and satisfied, and some who just can't get there?
Well, yes, and some of that is biological and some of that is psychological. For example, people have found that strokes on the left side of the brain actually are associated with more depression than strokes on the right side of the brain. That left side in the front of the brain seems to be important for giving people a boost in terms of their mood, and if that's then damaged, then their mood suffers. But I think it also depends on one's resources. Oftentimes when you have a stroke, you now need to look to others for help for a variety of services. Some people can't bathe themselves, need help walking. If you've got the resources, it may feel one way. If you've got to struggle and call out and the nurse doesn't come, that can feel very different.
Dr. Rosenthal, you were the first psychiatrist to diagnose seasonal affective disorder, or SAD, something many people here in the Northeast can understand. Now, does SAD or other factors in our emotional makeup magnify that perceived inability to handle adversity?
Yes, indeed it does. Anybody who's depressed for any reason might think him or herself less capable to handle adversity. But in fact, there are many things you can do, and that's the whole exciting thing about the story of SAD. I came from South Africa to New York. It was perhaps one of the greatest adversities that I faced in coming to the North because I have SAD myself. That's what helped me describe it. But the good news is that there are now many kinds of things you can do to make it feel better. Get more light, decrease their stress, get more exercise, plan properly, take vacations in sunny places, do whatever you can, and then once you've sort of conquered the sad or overcome it, you're able to be functional and happy again.
Well, Dr. Rosenthal, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Oh, it's a great pleasure, and I hope that your listeners enjoy my book.
Dr. Norman Rosenthal, clinical professor of psychiatry at Georgetown Medical School. He was the first psychiatrist to describe and diagnose seasonal affective disorder, and his most recent book is called The Gift of Adversity: The Unexpected Benefits of Life's Difficulties, Setbacks, and Imperfections. It's now out in paperback. There's more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, we're going to look into the future of music competition and hear from a music scientist who's exploring the limits of computational creativity. Could a machine become the next Beethoven? We'll find out when Word of Mouth continues. Stay with us.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The future of music is difficult to predict, but if current trends continue, it will likely involve computer programs and electronics. New Hampshire composer Greg Wilder doesn't know what the future of music holds, but as NHPR's Sean Hurley reports, the Warren resident is hoping to build the machine that writes it.
Greg Wilder and his wife, Allison Connard, are composers and computer programmers. Together in their log home in Warren, they design websites for artists. But music is at the heart of everything they do, and music is the first thing Greg Wilder can remember.
So I started music at the age of three. I actually started playing the piano at three. It was something that I was deeply obsessed with. I mean, it was really all I did.
Wilder put himself through music school by playing in jazz bands. After graduating, he continued composing while supporting himself by playing anywhere he could, often finding himself improvising in musical languages he wasn't familiar with.
That experience got me thinking, actually, a whole lot about how am I doing this? You know, like, I'm able to intuit this, but I don't even know how I'm doing it. You know, there's got to be some rules that I'm using in my mind to do it.
To find out what those rules might be, Wilder wrote a simple software program that could analyze different pieces of music and discern their similarity. And quite by accident, Wilder found that he'd created a tool with commercial potential. Venture capital was found, a team was hired, and Clio was born.
Clio was able to analyze millions of tracks of music and compare them all to determine which of those tracks are musically similar.
Although developing the similarity engine proved to be a kind of lost weekend to Wilder's larger goal, it provided him with a remarkable insight.
I realized that so many people are just copying other people, not knowing it. Right, there's so much of the same things that are going on.
Somewhere, someone, and maybe many someones, were busy composing songs similar, for example, to Wilder's own Winter Peace. The humbling conclusion stood in direct conflict to his goals as a composer.
As a composer, I'm always looking to expand and go out further to something new. I mean, that's what composers do, especially in the classical realm. We try to shoot out to where no man has been before, you know. It's hard for us to imagine this today, but in Beethoven's time, so much of the music that he was producing was unimaginable to those folks at that time.
Was there a way, Wilder wondered, to devise software that could survey the entire musical landscape and find those places that hadn't yet been explored? Could he create, in a word, the machine equivalent of a Beethoven?
And using machine learning techniques, figure out which aspects make the pieces unique. And by capturing that identifiable character, the idea is to then create new music that might contain some of that magic dust.
Wilder sold Clio and set to work on his next project, Isomer. Over the last decade, Isomer has bloomed into a suite of tools that not only analyzes every aspect of a given musical piece, but can ingest thousands of songs and create new music based on their forms. As an example, Wilder starts up Isomer and lifts the Dictionary of Musical Themes off the coffee table.
This is literally 10,000 musical themes. So I fed that into Isomer to start. So here is one of them, number 4,119. And from that, I had the machine then create 10,000 new melodies. And now, this is the cool part.
Wilder next has Isomer compare the 10,000 new themes with samples of music he most loves, Brahms, Beethoven, and some of his own work.
I fed that into Isomer and said, go find me melodies from this new library that are similar in certain characteristics to the Brahms, the Beethoven, and the Wilder.
Almost all of the 10,000 new themes were discarded by the parameter, but a short list of candidate melodies emerged. Wilder selected one, and then sent Isomer on its most complex task, to turn the selected melody into a full performance.
This is what it came up with.
Wilder doesn't suggest that Isomer's music is particularly listenable, but he believes he's begun to blur the line that divides man-made from machine-made.
I hope that I can live long enough to see the work through and to have the machine be creating music that no one knows is from a machine.
And working alongside Isomer.
I want to create sort of the music of the future, or music that has not been imagined before.
For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
And now we move from the future of music to its dark past. From Robert Johnson's mythical deal with the devil to Led Zeppelin's otherworldly imagery, a theory that the occult saved rock and roll. We'll get the lowdown when Word of Mouth continues after the break.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
Take the last train to Clarksville and I'll meet you at the station. You can be here by 4:30 because I've made your reservation.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Something happened to music in the mid-60s. In 1966, the Monkees rode Last Train to Clarksville to the top of the charts, landing alongside California Dreaming and Winchester Cathedral.
Winchester Cathedral, the armor ringing me down.
That same year, rock music aligned with the social changes sweeping the country and the availability of LSD, opening up a countercultural approach to reality and spirituality.
Turn off your mind, relax and float downstream. It is not dying.
That's the Beatles' Tomorrow Never Knows. The Rolling Stones also hit it big that year with Paint It Black, representing the darker side of the spiritual rebellion that gave rock its initial power. From Robert Johnson's mythical deal with the devil to the coded message in Led Zeppelin songs to the devilish imagery of heavy metal, the drive for the divine encounter rode shotgun with rock and roll, fueled by references to magic, arcane mysticism, Satan, the occult, and lots of drugs. It also kept rock and roll from dissolving into the sugary waste of the pop charts. And that is the theory put forth by author Peter Biebergall in a new book called Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. Peter Biebergall, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me again. Really a pleasure to be here.
So where did that legend about Robert Johnson making a deal with the devil at the crossroads come from, anyway?
What's interesting about the Robert Johnson myth is it really wasn't Robert Johnson originally that even knew about that idea about himself. It was another Johnson who had perpetuated a myth of learning how to play the guitar by meeting the devil at the crossroads. But this idea of a devil at the crossroads really comes from a West African and Haiti religious traditions whereby there were these deities, Legba, Father Legba in particular, who was a crossroads deity. He acted as a mediator between heaven and earth, or the spirit world, as it were. And when this deity made its way across the ocean over to America, he was transformed into the devil, because any of these deities that Africans had brought with them to the United States were not going to fit well with the Christianity that was important for them to be absorbed into.
Well, decent, God-fearing people have been saying rock and roll is the devil's music since it first broke through to white America. And even before that, the same charge was made of the blues, largely helped along by the myth of Robert Johnson's deal with the devil. What did you find about the origins of this association?
Well, I think that the first thing that was scaring white people was when they would catch their slaves in the South, slave owners, doing their what were called their hush harbor worship, which was a kind of Christian worship. They took to the story of salvation that was sort of forced onto them when they arrived in America, but they found their own way to worship using something in particular called the ring shout, which involved a very evocative and loud way of yelling out their worship of God. But that tradition of worship, that way of being religious, came with them from Africa. And so even though they were believing as Christians, they were worshiping as pagans, as their tribal past. And that was a very frightening thing for the white establishment to see. They saw that kind of rhythm. They heard that sounds of those drums as barbaric, as devilish. And they saw Christianity as something that could clean it out of them.
So later on, those traditions were carried into the black church. And there is the old trope about singing the blues on Saturday and then being in the pews on Sunday morning. The music essentially the same, the lyrics changed. You make the point that the blues actually offered some solutions that the church didn't.
That's right. And there's a wonderful variety of blues songs that speak very explicitly about using forms of voodoo or voodoon as a way to charm the woman that you love or try to make a little extra money. And so these obviously are practices that the church would not have approved of. But people don't always live their faith exactly as the church would have them. And so you have a tradition that was brought to the South coming from these different countries like Haiti and West Africa, and bringing along with them these traditions that involved what we would call occult practices. And that easily made its way into the music.
So there is a spiritual rebellion that rose along with what became rhythm and blues and rock and roll music. Here's an example. Here's the Isley Brothers Shout, parts 1 and 2, evoking the church and that uncut emotion that was feared by white America.
You know you make me wanna shout, kick my heels up and shout, throw my hands up and shout, throw my head back and shout. Come on now, don't forget to say you will. Don't forget to say yeah, 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 yeah.
Say you will.
Say it right now, baby.
Say you will.
Come on, baby. Come on.
Say you will.
Say it better, yeah.
Say you will.
Come on now.
Such an irony there that Elvis Presley, who brought black music to white America, was feared for his swiveling hips, which he said he learned where? In the Pentecostal church.
That's right. And there's a wonderful story of an early Pentecostal preacher who's trying to get his congregants to shout and to dance and to praise the Lord. And he says, "We can't let the devil keep all this good rhythm."
When you say that the occult saved rock and roll, we should clarify what you mean by occultism, which you define pretty broadly.
Very broadly. So really what I want to talk about and what I talk about in the book is the occult imagination. And the occult imagination includes both the ways in which people believe. People have always long believed in spirits and the spirit world and being able to communicate with them and being able to divine the future and being able to cast a spell. It was very part of really of early religion. People have also been afraid of those practices. People saw those in opposition to mainstream religions where you had somebody mediating those things for you. You shouldn't be on your own, left to your own devices to try to speak to spirits. There are priests and rabbis who take care of that business for you. So you have really this whole spectrum of the ways in which people both are afraid of it, believe in it, maybe don't believe in it at all, but are interested in the humor of it or how it can be used to sell an album by putting an upside down pentagram on the cover.
So it's less nefarious than kind of casting aside the convention, which is endemic to rock and roll. And so is, or was, sexuality. Now, where does that more decadent search for salvation come into this?
Well, I think sex is absolutely the essential way to spiritually rebel, because sex is long used as an indicator of sin, of being on the side of the devil. And so when you have a sense of sexual freedom and you can somehow underpin that, say, in the 60s with a sense of spiritual freedom as well, well, now you've really charged it up.
So you point out that this is cynical in a sense, or let's say calculated, you know, a great way to sell an album. But there were genuine seekers there. And I want to talk about Jimmy Page and Robert Plant of Led Zeppelin. Here is some of that mythical imagery, in this case, Tolkien characters in the song Ramble On. This is from Led Zeppelin 2.
Just in the darkest depths of Mordor, I met a girl so fair. But Gollum and the evil one crept up and slipped away with her, yeah. I knew nothing happened to her. I guess I'll keep on rambling. I'm gonna shake it, see how I got up my mind.
On the early pressings of the album that followed were etched the words, "Do what thou wilt." Now, this is a core belief of the English occultist Aleister Crowley. Jimmy Page had a kind of Crowley fixation, but you point out that it wasn't satanic.
No, and there's long been the association that anything occult has to do with Satan. And I think sometimes occultists like Aleister Crowley at the time liked to continue that association because it gave him an aura of being dangerous, who had access to hidden knowledge. But we're really talking about somebody who saw the occult as a means of personal liberation, of personal freedom. And again, we can look all through back and look at artists and musicians, and we can see that this idea of artistic freedom was often tied with a spiritual freedom. And that often meant having to bump up against both the mainstream artistically and the mainstream religiously. So in the case of these young musicians at the time, Robert Plant and Jimmy Page, doing something that was so unique and having access suddenly to a lot of money and things that they didn't have before allowed them to explore ideas that they maybe didn't necessarily have access to, or at least be able to dig a little bit deeper. And so I think it's very normal for somebody their age at the time to be interested in these kinds of things in the same way their fans were. But they could take it a little bit further because they had the means and they also had music, which was a way for them to express these ideas.
And they had an audience.
Yes, and they changed rock and roll.
We're talking with the author Peter Biebergall, who says that rock's essential rebellious spirit is a spiritual rebellion at its core. He's the author of a new book called Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. And he makes the case that all of the alternative and countercultural spiritualism that was brewing in mid-century America found a perfect vehicle in rock and roll and spread it to the masses. Well, how many kids slow dancing to Stairway to Heaven? You know, I remember that. Yeah, studying album covers and lyrics and looking for clues into meanings. But look at Charles Manson's claim that the White Album commanded him to murder, several murders in the 1960s. Couldn't teenagers or anyone with enough time divine whatever meaning they wanted from this music, occultist or not?
Absolutely. And that's kind of the danger, I guess, of any kind of magical thinking and really in any kind of religious or spiritual idea. I mean, the thing about we go to great lengths to try to separate occult thought from what we might call traditional religious thought. But really, some of the same psychological activities are at play, which is accepting the idea of some transcendent reality, accepting the idea that somehow human beings can have some interaction with the divine. And so whether you are a Christian fundamentalist or whether you are a believer in the occult, you could spend time looking for symbols and trying to extract meaning. What's amazing about rock and roll was that what we might call the occult imagination found a perfect vehicle in this music to express itself.
Well, I think of Mick Jagger, you know, prancing around with the sort of persona of the devil and singing Sympathy for the Devil, a song more about the chaos of the 60s. But for him, it was about the power over audiences that it conferred. And likewise, you know, you write about Black Sabbath later admitting that their darkness was calculated, social and spiritual defiance for working class boys. Now, wasn't that also true of listeners and fans, you know, glomming onto some kind of mystery that might distinguish them from their family or their peers?
That's right. And we do that all the time. I mean, let's take a moment where we go to see a magic show. I mean, we live in, you know, it's 2014, and anybody who goes to see a magician, even on the street or in a theater, knows that there's a trick, knows that it's not real magic. And yet we go into those situations allowing ourselves to be hypnotized by that. We want to be enchanted. And the same with the fans and their music. There's, I think, the very same transmission that's going on between the magician and the audience, the musician and the audience, and maybe even in ancient religious traditions, the shaman and the tribe.
You write also about David Bowie's obsession with aliens, you know, Yes's album covers, prog rock, Hotel California, Jay-Z playing with Illuminati symbols, and goths. When did this all stop, Peter?
I don't think it's actually stopped. I do think there's a new generation of musicians who are seeing what can actually be really fun about these ideas, that maybe, you know, we're not living in a time where, like in the 70s, where you could go buy your ESP testing cards in the bookstores. But there's certainly a whole new generation that is in love with horror movies, that's in love with comic books, that wants to play Dungeons and Dragons, that still is interested in the fantastic and the fantastical. And even though science sort of dominates our understanding of the world, that there's still a way that we can let this imagination have its place in our pop culture. And there's many musicians that are still seeing that, you know what, there's something really interesting about the way these images and these ideas can be presented and can actually enhance the experience of listening to this music.
Anyone you can think of that's doing it particularly well?
Well, there's a really great underground movement, although the underground today really doesn't function in the same way. There's a band called Sun. And the lead is
S-U-N or S-O-N?
Well, they spell it S-U-N, and then there's a O with a bunch of closed parentheses. and they model it after actually an amplifier company named Sun, and that was their logo. And the lead of that, or really the creative force behind it, is a fellow named Stephen O'Malley. And what he's doing is he stages Sun concerts where they literally wear robes and have fog machines. And he uses the language of heavy metal, but is really producing some incredible, almost orchestral kind of rock and roll with down-tuned guitars and deep, heavy sounds that, going to one of their concerts, it's so loud that you can actually feel it vibrating in your chest. And I think he really sees that there's a way of mixing these ideas, these images, and this music, something that maybe is a little bit sinister sounding, and it can actually transport you.
So, Peter, were the preachers right all along? Is rock and roll really the devil's music?
It certainly is.
Peter Biebergall, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Peter Biebergall is author of three books, most recently Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. You'll find more, including some reviews of the book, at wordofmouthradio.org.
Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste. I've been around for a long, long year. Stole many a man's soul away.
Thank you so much for listening today. We promise that if you played this show backwards, there would be no messages that will compromise your immortal or mortal soul. And that's true of everything at wordofmouthradio.org, where there's a full archive, so if you missed any part of the show, you can catch up. You can also subscribe to the Word of Mouth podcast. Find it on iTunes or find the link at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks for helping us spread the word on Word of Mouth. And join us for more tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.